Session number 17392, Reel 2.
Well, as I was saying, the other unit which the operator had and was mounted underneath the indicator unit with the display on called a switch unit, which as its name implied had switches for setting the range scale and so on, and the drum which controlled a marker on the tube, a range marker, which was adjusted so that the ring passed through the response and enabled the operator to read off its range from the scale on the drum. But I suppose the other key elements which were further back in the aircraft were the power unit, quite fundamental, the receiver, and the modulator and transmitter. The transmitter was mounted actually on the framework supporting the scanner, which as I mentioned earlier had a parabolic reflector of aperture of 3 feet, which was mounted in a cupola under the fuselage of the aircraft in a position which originally had intended to be occupied by an underbelly gun turret, which was in fact was never introduced to service. But fortunately, in the Halifax, at any rate, the hole was already there, so it was possible to mount the scanner with its motors and so on in the hole, and the scanner underneath protected by the radome of Perspex cupola.
Did those who were to operate it readily get the hang of it?
It was a bit of a struggle at first. In fact, one of the senior TRE boffins, Dr. O'Kane, who was seconded from GEC, came up to help to start the operator's training, and he was rather pessimistic at first about their ability to cope with the thing. However, they did conquer it and did very well with it on the whole. I think the biggest difficulty really was understanding the nature of the responses from a given target. There was a tendency for people at first to think that, oh well, you will get a reflection from a target which will, from a town which will resemble what you've got on the map. In fact, that doesn't work out, particularly if the town's in a valley or there's some undulation running through it. The nature of the buildings give different responses, and the understanding of what goes to make up a radar response on the tube from an H2S system was still being investigated after the war.
What if the enemy had captured the equipment at this stage?
Well, they did fairly early on, and in fact the Germans called it the Rotterdam equipment because they got it out of a crashed aircraft at Rotterdam. They did a attempt to do some form of jamming, but that was never very satisfactory because with the rotating beam you could only see the jammer at the instant it was pointing at the jammer, so they couldn't blot out the the entire picture. They never really got down to themselves to producing a night bomber force, although they did produce a version of it, of an H2S system. And in fact, one was brought to Malvern at the end of the war, when I'll come to it later, when I went back to Malvern. And it was beautifully engineered, but it had a very small diameter CRT, as I recall, about 4 inches compared with our 9 inches, and some very clever mechanical features in ease of servicing and so on. But I don't think there was any evidence that it went into production or was used, because later in the war, Germany was forced into putting their aircraft industry into making fighters to try and kill Bomber Command. So they never got round to building up or rebuilding their bomber force.
Can you take me further on of your memories?
Yeah.
With 35 Squadron after the first raid, please?
Yes, the number of attacks mounted using H2S rapidly increased throughout 1943. When we got to May, or thereabouts, the bomber offensive was switched to the Ruhr, and then H2S was not the primary means of attacking the target. Certainly it helped in navigation on the way, but the Oboe-equipped Mosquitoes, the Pathfinder force, with their supreme accuracy, were used to mark the Ruhr throughout the whole Battle of the Ruhr. So in the summer of 1943, 35 Squadron was really in the backer-up role on the Ruhr, but all kinds of other targets were attacked. The chaps never knew really where they were going until they were called in for briefing, ranging from attacking submarine pens in northern France to going all the way to Italy to attack installations and ports there, and some of the larger cities outside the Ruhr in Germany. At the end of July, one of the heaviest raids undertaken up to that time was mounted on Hamburg, and that was marked by H2S primarily, and resulted, as you will no doubt know, in the notorious firestorm developing. It was the raid about which the German minister, oh dear, the name's gone now, Hitler's architect, who became the head of
Speer,
that's right, said that, told Hitler that if the Bomber Command went on doing this to so many other cities, it would effectively destroy their war effort. And by the autumn of 43, of course, the Battle of Berlin was being mounted, and there, this problem of analysing the target responses from a target on the radar tube really became very serious, because Berlin, such a size that the responses flooded the whole tube, and the operators had extreme difficulty. So when one talks about area bombing, I maintain that area bombing was inevitable with the means we had of identifying. So when some critics of Bomber Command say that we deliberately set out with a policy, certainly I believe that was written down as a policy, but in fact the words were empty, because that's all we could do anyway. So an attempt was made to improve the definition by going to the 3-centimeter system, which I mentioned as coming later, and I was not personally involved at that time because the first 6 equipments, which were produced in a great big rush and collaboration with between Bernard Lovell and our boss Don Bennett, went to Lancaster's, and it was not until the spring of 44 that 35 Squadron converted to Lancaster's and went straight to the 3-centimeter Mark III equipment. But more or less coincidental with that, I was moved to Witten, as I mentioned earlier, where 83 Squadron were operating Lancaster's with Mark III H2S.
Did you say that was March 44?
March 44, that's right. So as far as 35 and Gravely was concerned, I was there from the beginning of November 42 till March 44.
And at Witten, you said you were
I was the station radar officer, which meant I had an overall responsibility for the radar in the squadrons there, not only the Lancasters but the Mosquito squadrons, and was also a small radar development section there. But in April, late April, I can't remember the exact date, it was certainly about 6 weeks after I went there, the well-known argument over methods between Don Bennett and Cochrane surfaced, and 2 Pathfinder squadrons were sent back to 5 Group on CNC's instructions. One of them was 83 Squadron, so I was left with no operational heavy bomber radar to be concerned directly with, although indirectly through the Lancaster servicing section and the radar development squadron there. But clearly I was not as fully stretched as I had been at 35 Squadron. And when towards the end of 44 Don Bennett got wind of a further development of H2S to use a larger scanner, 6-foot aperture linear waveguide array, which would reduce the beam width to 1.5 degrees, Don Bennett pressed very hard for this to be rushed through to deal with the Berlin problem. And Lovell said to Bennett, apparently, that he would do this, but he hadn't got sufficient effort. Would Bennett provide some effort? Which he did, and which was me. So I was sent back to TRE this time to actually do development work. And I was there at TRE for the remainder of the war.
When did you go back to TRE?
In December 44.
Any more specific memories from your time at Witten that we can record, please?
Sorry for the long pause, but I don't think there was anything outstanding.
Were you aware of this debate between Don Bennett and Cochrane?
Oh yes, we were all very much aware of it. The crews, so far as 83 was concerned, I don't know about 97 with the other squadron, they were very dismayed at leaving the Pathfinder force proper. But of course a lot has been written about that by people much more qualified to comment than I.
Did the enemy ever attack Witten, or for that matter Gravely, whilst you were there?
Not a not a real attack in terms of dropping bombs on the aircraft, but there were, of course, intruders that from time to time appeared over all the bomber airfields and had a crack at the chaps when they came back and were waiting to land. And there was one night when, possibly more, but one I remember particularly while I was at Gravely, when they dropped these anti-personnel so-called butterfly bombs with a trembler thing. And I suppose that was probably the closest I ever came to something of that nature. I used to have a girlfriend in St. Neots, and I used to cycle down to see her and cycle back to Gravely. And cycling back one night, when I came to a crossroads, I heard a bang fairly close, and I stopped and I wondered what on earth it was, got on my bike, and then I heard another bang. Well, the next day I gathered that there had been a small number of these anti-personnel bombs dropped just at that point, but fortunately not close to the road. But seemingly my movement had triggered them off.
What were the technical problems that you had doing your job at Witten?
At Witten?
Yes.
Well, I would say the biggest thing that we undertook while I was there in the experimental section was attempting to eliminate polar diagram fades, even with the improved 3-centimeter H2S and a redesigned scanner reflector. There was still a tendency for responses to fade at a critical point in the run towards the target and then appear again later. And it was suggested by one of the engineers at Malvern that this could be improved by inserting a perspex plate between the aerial horn and the reflector. The exact position of the plate and its spacing out from the reflector could affect this fade, and so we attempted to measure the polar diagram of each scanner in the whole of the group, took it into Witten and put it on a mounting on the roof of the radar hut with a detector remote from it, moved it round and plotted out the polar diagram and adjusted the plate. This work went on, as I recall, for quite a number of weeks. That was the only really significant thing that I could think of. Most of the other things were fairly minor, getting modifications done to correct this, that, or the other.
Did Don Bennett pay any visits to either Gravely or Witten whilst you were there? Did you actually meet him?
Oh, yes, yes. He was a frequent visitor all over the group. He travelled extensively. He used to come into the interrogations. Every raid he went somewhere, and sometimes to more than one station, to see the crews when they got back. He was an absolute ball of fire.
In what way?
Well, I mean, he didn't let himself relax. He entered into absolutely everything. And incidentally, we all had the highest regard for him.
What specifically gave you such a high opinion of him?
Well, in a nutshell, his press-on spirit, and the fact that we all knew that he could do the jobs himself. He was undoubtedly one of the most experienced airmen in most categories, even on the engineering side. He had a good knowledge.
Did you ever see anything of Cochrane?
No, never. I don't think he would have dared to venture into 8 Group territory.
Or Harris himself?
No, not until I never met Harris till after the war. I think it's fairly well known that his leadership was quite an incredible thing, because the troops never saw anything of him. He was so damn busy here in his headquarters at High Wycombe, and yet they worshipped him. At the really big Bomber Command reunion in the Albert Hall after the war, 47, 48, can't remember exactly, the whole audience there were calling for, "We want Bert, we want Bert." Actually they said Butch, because that was said in affectionate terms, not in Butch for Butcher, as some of his opponents have tried afterwards. And when the BBC Light programme went over to the Albert Hall for the concert part of it, all they heard at first was this great cries of "We want Butch" from the entire audience. By that time, of course, he had gone to South Africa.
Now, you said that in December of 1944 you went back to TRE. Can you tell me about the work that you had to do when you got there?
Yes. The big improvement that was sought was derived from this 6-foot scanner, affectionately known as Whirligig, with a slotted waveguide array with a beam width of about 1.5 degrees. Now, to take advantage of that, one needed also an indicator with much better focus, and an indicator with those sort of properties had been developed for use with a system with an even shorter wavelength, which sadly turned out to have no future, because the wavelength picked happened to coincide with the maximum attenuation by water vapor, a phenomenon that simply was not known until they had produced magnetrons and tried to use them. Then they found that as the aircraft climbed, the signals disappeared, and of course it didn't penetrate cloud like the lower the longer wavelengths did. So this indicator existed, the scanner existed, but it was not a system. It required development of a new waveform generator and altering all the connections and so on. And my job with a small team of Canadian radar mechanics was to sort this out. I actually was a design authority for the waveform generator and for the system, and the mechanics hand-built a number of sets pending getting production of this waveform generator from a small firm called RF Equipment. But the war ended before the equipment could go into service. It was thought it might go on to the Tiger Force, which was being set up for the final round with Japan, but that was overtaken by the atom bomb. So my, if I may use the possessive, my H2S Mark never actually went into service. But the improvements that it introduced were built into H2S Mark 4A, which was the system for the Lincoln bomber, which remained in service until the V bombers came along in the 50s. So the work really wasn't lost. It was built into the next Mark.
Did you have anything much to do with the Allies who might be interested in acquiring the system?
Don't think so. I can't recall anything. Well, of course, the Americans were brought in to the H2S picture right from almost from the start. When they first came across Europe with the flying fortresses, the B-17s, the Liberators, they were supremely optimistic about being able to deal with their marvellous Norden bombsight, which, from what I know, I'm not an expert in that field, was a superb piece of equipment. And they'd used it in training in the States and so on, very confident that they didn't need any of the aids that we had. They rapidly changed their minds when they tried to operate in European weather conditions. And this resulted in Lovell being directed to provide effort to equip at Deford a number of B-17s to act as the lead ships, as they call them, in their formations. Similarly, I understand with Obo, and a large number of the American attacks were marked with Obo. The Norden bombsight certainly was incredibly accurate when you could see the target, but in European conditions this was not all that frequent. So when they couldn't see the target and use the Norden bombsight, they had to use H2S, so they very rapidly developed their own version of it, and it was, as you would expect with the immense American resources, beautifully engineered.
What was Lovell like to work for?
He was a very dynamic leader, a very hard taskmaster. He didn't spare himself, and he didn't spare anyone working for him. And again, rather like Don Bennett, those that did work for him had an immense regard and respect for him.
So that meant long hours, did it?
Yes, when necessary, yes. Certainly in the early stages.
Going back to the home guard in Maidstone, is there anything we can record about your memories of that, please?
Yes. Well, of course, originally it was known as the Local Defence Volunteers, or the LDV, and all the boys, 16 and over, went down to the police station and volunteered, those of us who were in the OTC, the Officers Training Corps. And once we had our own little parade, so I suppose we must have become a platoon in the LDV. And the task that we had was to mount a guard on an electricity substation and patrol the area. Of course, nothing ever happened. We did find a car one night that had not been immobilised, and this was, of course, supposed to be a heinous crime at the time, in case parachutists were dropped and used it. I fired my only shot in the war, I think, easing springs and not noticing that I still got one round in the spout. That's about all I can remember of it. I suppose I must have left before it became known as the Home Guard. I can't be very clear about this, but you see, when I went to join the BBC, it was November 42. Then Home Guard formed what in the summer of November 40. I keep making this same mistake. Formed in the summer of 40, so I suppose I was only in it for 3 or 4 months.